From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Before he made the film Henry V, the Irish-born actor Kenneth Branagh went through years of study trying to perfect a BBC accent. But for his new movie, Dead Again, Branagh had to talk like a wisecracking detective from Los Angeles. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk with Kenneth Branagh about how he talks. Also today, we meet saxophonist David Sanborn. And commentator and teacher Maureen Corrigan tells us how she psychs herself up for another semester of school. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Soviet Parliament has suspended the Communist Party from all political activity while the party's leaders are investigated for complicity in last week's failed coup. The ban effectively ends 70 years of communist power. The Supreme Soviet also voted to strip its former speaker, Anatoly Lukyanov, of parliamentary immunity so that he can be tried on charges of involvement in the Kremlin takeover. The Soviet republics of Russia and the Ukraine have signed an agreement that circumvents the central government and, in effect, creates a new way for the republics to relate to one another. The BBC's Kevin Connolly reports that the Ukrainian Prime Minister, Leonid Kravchuk, is calling on other republics to adopt the Russian-Ukrainian plan.
The Ukrainian leadership is determined to ensure that it will be the republics themselves, not any renewed central government, which determine the limits of future economic cooperation. Mr. Kravchuk said he'd like the leaders of all 15 republics to meet, but he added he hoped there'd be no invitation for Mr. Gorbachev. That, he said, would make it all look too much like the old days. Ukrainian nationalists have some reservations about the speedy conclusion of the Treaty of Cooperation the republic leadership has now signed with Russia, but by and large they're relieved that Mr. Kravchuk stood his ground on the issue of Ukrainian independence. There's a widespread acceptance, though, that achieving that independence will be a long and complex process. Mr. Kravchuk says the Ukraine doesn't want nuclear weapons and has now begun what promises to be a long series of meetings with military commanders on the delicate questions raised by his government's determination, eventually anyway, to see the Soviet army withdraw from its territory.
The BBC's Kevin Connolly. Tens of thousands of demonstrators throughout Yugoslavia have demanded the resignations of the Federal Defense Minister and senior military leaders. The protests are part of growing domestic and international pressure for an end to the bloodshed in Croatia. Pierre Vickery reports from Zagreb.
Huge anti-war demonstrations took place in dozens of towns and villages throughout Yugoslavia. A large crowd packed the Zagreb city center in Croatia's largest anti-war protest in decades. They chanted, "Down with the generals, our children are not your property, and we want the return of our sons." Similar protests were staged in all major Croatian centers, as well as in Bosnia and Macedonia. Meanwhile, thousands of women from all over Yugoslavia have traveled to the federal capital, Belgrade, to demonstrate in front of the defense ministry. Serbian police were originally reported to have turned back dozens of buses, but the demonstrators were finally allowed to pass after several hundred Serbian women staged a sit-down protest in the Belgrade city center. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 5 points to close at 3,049.64. This is NPR News. Leaders of the warring factions in Cambodia ended a four-day power-sharing conference today without reaching agreement on key measures to end the country's 12-year civil war. The conference chairman, Prince Norodom Sihanouk, said that compromises had been reached on some issues. He said, however, that the factions remain deadlocked on the issues of how to disband the opposing armies and how to prepare for national elections. The chief delegate for the Khmer Rouge guerrillas called on the United Nations to send a peacekeeping force to Cambodia at once. The next round of talks is set for late October. A study in the latest Science magazine suggests that there's a difference between the brains of homosexual and heterosexual men. But as NPR's Richard Harris reports, this difference doesn't prove that there's a biological basis for homosexuality.
2 years ago, researchers in Los Angeles discovered that a part of the brain apparently related to male sexual behavior is twice as big in men as it is in women. So Simon LeVay at the Salk Institute in San Diego decided to see whether this sand grain-sized part of the brain differs between gay men and straight men. He studied 19 gay men who had died of AIDS, and he did find a difference. This part of the brain was half as big in these gay men as it was in apparently straight men. But the study does not show whether the men were born with this difference or whether something about being gay affected this area of the brain. And researchers caution that a study so small needs to be repeated elsewhere because the observation could just be a fluke. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
Officials at the federal prison in Talladega, Alabama, have sent food to rioting Cuban inmates and their 9 remaining hostages. The section of the prison taken over by the Cubans has been without food for more than a week. The food was delivered a few hours after the inmates gave up one ailing hostage. 7 men and 2 women remain as captives of the Cubans, who say they're prepared to die rather than be deported to Cuba. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A couple of years ago, a 28-year-old Kenneth Branagh directed and starred in an acclaimed film adaptation of Henry V. You might have thought this alumnus of the Royal Shakespeare Company and founder of the Renaissance Theatre Company would have continued in a classical direction with his next film. But he hasn't. Branagh directed and stars in the new movie Dead Again. Critic Owen Gleiberman describes it as unpretentious, garishly, thrillingly vulgar, with twists and turns that never existed anywhere but in old movies, stitched together in an ingenious new way. Dead Again is about a Los Angeles detective tracking down the identity of a woman with amnesia. Under hypnosis, the only thing she remembers is a glamorous musical couple of the 1940s. She and the detective may be this couple's reincarnation. Branagh and his wife Emma Thompson play dual roles. Because of the flashbacks, making Dead Again was like making 2 movies. One a contemporary thriller, and the other a 40s melodrama, which Branagh decided should be in black and white.
In one version of the script, the scenes were written and described as being shot in black and white. In another version, they weren't. And to be perfectly honest, I wasn't sure. So I talked to the lighting cameraman, Matthew Leonetti, and I said, look, how can we hedge our bets here? And so we talked about doing what eventually turned out to be the case. We shot that footage on colour stock, but we printed it eventually for black and white. And we lit it, in fact, in order to, as you might have lit for black and white, in order to provide enough contrast, in order to give enough shadow and texture to the look. And we tested it so that we knew that, yes, it would work both ways. When we then decided that it was definitely going to aid the storytelling clarity to keep it in black and white, then we experimented with quite how black and white it should be, and I think that starts to answer your question. I mean, once you literally mess around with the chemical bath in which you're printing your stuff, then you can make that black and white a little bluer, a little sheenier, a little greener, a little whatever. And we went for a slightly a blue sheen on the top of it, which I think is in tune with and in keeping with some of the real look of some of those old black and white movies. And that was quite a delicate process that took quite some time once we decided to go with the black and white. But we were always, because we knew that this was a possibility, the choice of textures and the look of costumes and the cut of costumes and the sense of richness, the way the dresses moved and the whole look of the party sequences and the nightclub sequences, and the way the material hung, particularly the women's dresses, and particularly on Margaret Strass, was we took a great deal of time over in order to achieve a sort of elegant simplicity that felt effortless but deeply glamorous and highly romantic.
Now, since you play 2 different roles in the movie, you get to play 2 different characters, one a European composer from the 40s, the other a contemporary American detective. And so you have 2 different styles of acting, 2 different accents in it. Before we talk about your accent, I'm interested in hearing if there was a particular type of actor, a particular type of acting style from the period or from the place that you were trying to get in each.
Well, with Roman Strauss, who is a rather tormented composer in the 40s, who has come to Los Angeles from Germany, where he's been very famous and where he is now trying to write an opera in order to establish a fame equal to that he has found in Europe. He was literally based on some German expatriates, including Thomas Mann and Schoenberg and Bertolt Brecht, who moved to Hollywood just after the war, but also film-wise, based on the kind of character that the more unconventional leading men, often European leading men, of the cinema of the time would have looked like, the kind of Charles Boyers, the Paul Mooneys, the little later on the David Nivens, the sort of suave, debonair actors, the ones with lots of eyebrows moving all over the place and slightly pomaded and a little curl to the hair at the side and perhaps a little grey here to look distinguished. We were encouraged by the look of, for instance, Laurence Olivier as Maxime de Winter in Rebecca. We don't really do that, but we're in that sort of vein.
Now, the Mike Church character, the contemporary American detective character, this is a much more loose-limbed, casual type of character you're playing. Mm. What kind of American actor did you base this part of the performance on?
Well, I suppose that It was more based, strangely enough, on the author of Dead Again, Scott Frank, who is the same age as I am and sort of the same size. And he is a Los Angelino, born and bred. And he recorded the part for me on tape so that I could listen to it on one of those little tape recorders. I also, in pre-production, I remember I started it on Labor Day of last year. I went out having spent some weeks preparing with two excellent dialect coaches, Carla Meyer and Susan Hegarty, with my accent, which to begin with had started very East Coast and nasal and mad and over-gesticulatory. And on Labor Day, I finally got the courage to go out to the pictures as an American. And I tried it out. I bought my popcorn as an American, and then I remember buying some books as an American, and that day I started to, rather strangely actually, walk behind people in the street and in the shopping mall to get a sense of what you just mentioned, this loose-limbed quality. I think born out of spending, luckily, a great deal of time in the sun, as opposed to us rather cold Northern European types who are all a little bit more straight-laced and physically held in.
What was some of the advice that your voice coaches gave you on how to speak American?
Well, I think a key thing was to pay attention to the smaller words, like what, you know. And instead of saying what, you'd say what, and lots of little abbreviated things like that. Not to gesture too much. I mean, I really did start very kind of, you know, overblown and kind of nasal and mad and completely non-understandable. And I literally had to travel my accent across the country. It was like getting on the accent train. And it went pretty much via Alabama and all sorts of places until it really took time living in Los Angeles to hear. What we were trying to go for was a sort of neutral West Coast sound, which I think people fairly rightly think does not really constitute a distinctive accent in the same way as a Southern accent or a you know, Brooklyn accent. But in a sense, it makes it somehow more difficult to do because there are definite sounds, but they're subtle.
I don't mean to ask you to, like, do stunts for us or anything, but would you say a few words for us in the kind of West Coast American that you came up with for the movie?
Well, you know, I kind of feel slightly uncomfortable doing it, you know, because it seems so tailor-made. I feel as though I need Mike Church's jacket on, you know, Mike Church's trousers, and I need to be in his apartment. Do you mind if I don't? Because
No, that's fine.
It's that sort of weird, mysterious, acting-y thing, you know, where, you know, it's all to do with a whole set of other things, you know, that go with it. I don't understand it, but I respect it.
My guest is Kenneth Branagh, and he directed and stars in the new movie, Dead Again. He also directed and starred in the recent film adaptation of Henry V. I'm going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Actor and director Kenneth Branagh is my guest. You know, we're talking about the American accent that you do in your new movie. I think accent has always been crucial for you, having grown up in Belfast. You had an accent when you started acting that would have been considered, I think, unacceptable for a classical actor in England.
Yeah, I mean, the Belfast accent is a very hard one, you know, that is quite, when people speak very quickly, it's very hard to understand because it's very nasal and very got very sharp edges. But it's one that, I mean, I left Belfast when I was 9, so although there were very formative years there, and indeed one feels very Irish, I moved to a part of England that was so suburban and wonderfully bland, actually, that it that after a while it produces the blanded, rounded tones you hear before you.
you write in your memoir that when you got to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts in England, that everybody around you sounded like they spoke on the BBC every day, and you felt like you were talking really differently, and you were very self-conscious.
Yeah, it's a very sort of fundamental thing, I think, one's identity as partly defined by the way one sounds. And of course, Britain still remains riddled by the notion of class, and as manifested in all sorts of conflicts between people from the provinces and people from the city and people from different income groups, and one means of telling all that is the way people speak. So it's a for everybody in England, I think it's an ongoing. One's very aware of it, and I guess in a sense it was very helpful to become an actor, because you are encouraged to produce a sort of neutral sound, a neutral accent, if you like, that helps you get work. Because basically, potential employers have so little imagination that if you walk in with a strong regional accent, and you're perhaps auditioning for a part that requires, say, BBC English, they, on the whole, don't believe you can do it. If you walk in with a neutral accent and you're perhaps auditioning for a part with a regional accent, they tend to believe you can. And so the harsh employment realities of that meant that we all had to change a bit, and all the more sort of tight-assed newsreader types had to calm it down a bit, and those of us with slightly more regional brogues had to even him up a bit. But eventually, you know, as an actor, I think it's quite useful to have a sort of rather anonymous voice in a way, so that, I mean, as for instance in Dead Again, one can then have great fun sounding completely different.
Now, you wrote in your memoir that voice teachers were particularly hard on you. Why? Mm.
Well, what happens when you, or at least what happened when I started at drama school, was there's a process of, I suppose you could loosely call it, breaking down in order to sort of build you up again. That is to say that they make you aware of every habitual physical misuse that you may indulge in. So if you have very bad posture, if you have stooped shoulders, if you have, as I had and have, a rather stiff jaw, if you're the arch in your back throws your stomach out and you don't rest your weight evenly on your feet, and if you have a lisp or you have funny teeth or you have anything that does not allow you to produce what was a favourite phrase of my voice teachers, which was rich, dark, golden brown sound. And if you couldn't produce rich, dark, golden brown sound, they let you know that you had a stiff jaw, that your tongue was too short, that you had dark L's, whatever they are, and that you were more or less a physical wreck. And over the course of 7 terms, I think the idea was to allow you to analyse those things, to be in control of them, to be in control of your short tongue, your dark L's, make them light L's, perhaps, improve your posture, do Alexander technique and all things connected to being a perfect physical specimen. So it was sometimes a painful process, but it was it did indeed do just that. It made you aware of all the things that our very imperfect bodies sometimes prevent us from doing if we're trying to be amazing acting machines.
So in what way, though, were your voice teachers particularly hard on you?
Well, they said I had a very stiff jaw, and that I projected from the throat rather than from the ribs and the diaphragm, and that I also had a rolling gait. I had, because my jaw was stiff and my neck was also stiff. They described it as when I started acting, you know, everything tensed up, you know. So they spent a long time trying to sort of relax me and allow the sound to come from further down in one's body. So you've got more resonance as the sound comes up from your tummy and, you know, resonates in your ribs rather than starting in your throat and only having your mouth to resonate in. It's a much thinner sound. And it was all very technical and everything, and but very, in the end, very interesting. And, you know, we used to do the inane exercises, sitting around with our hands on our knees, all facing each other, doing whether the weather be hot or whether the weather be fine, or whether the weather be cold or whether the weather be ooji flip. Whatever the weather, will weather the weather, whether we like it or not. And I spent 7 terms doing this kind of stuff, with whether the weather coming from my stomach and going through my my dark L's, my short tongue, my stiff jaw, my thick neck, my rolling gait, and all the other. I mean, I left feeling like, you know, it was going to be Kenneth Quasimodo Branagh entering the acting profession, you know.
Not exactly a confidence-building exercise, is it?
No, it isn't, but it's it makes you aware. It makes you aware of certain limitations that you might put on yourself if you're not careful.
Well, do you think all that weather the weather stuff is part of the reason why you have such command over your voice, which I really think you do?
Well, it certainly has made one aware of, clarity. As an adolescent, partly because of what we were talking about earlier, I think partly because of not feeling one quite belonged where I was living, having come from Belfast and a large, extended, working-class family with lots of aunts and uncles and cousins and things, the sense of knowing exactly where one belonged was very strong. And when I was displaced from that particular environment, which many people are in all sorts of different ways all over the world, you often feel at a loss. And one of the things I think it does in adolescence, particularly, is it you attempt to hide by mumbling. So I spent a lot of my adolescence kind of talking like that, so that when people ask me things, I just say things like that, so that somehow I wouldn't be noticed. So drama school, in a sense, was a chance to re-educate myself and feeling and building that little more confidence, and then being given technical means by which one could express oneself more clearly and actually enjoy doing it. And then as one began to work on Shakespeare and some other classical texts, not only did you have some means by which you could express yourself clearly and technical equipment with which to do it, but you also had rather marvellous words which needed just that, because you can't mumble your way through a Shakespeare speech. You can't, without sufficient breath, do a big chunk of whatever, I don't know, Once More Unto the Breach or any of those things, or indeed convey any of the long, rather complicated thoughts that are sometimes in those plays without the technical equipment. But it was a drama school was a sort of an awakening through those technical means of a certain part of my personality, which I think had been rather damped down by being displaced from the environment that I felt most comfortable in.
So you think a lot of the coaching that you got and a lot of the vocal coaching that you got carried over into your personality as well as in the roles that you played?
I think so. I mean, it gave one a little more confidence in those basic communicative skills, you know, the fact that, you know, one was encouraged to speak up and to speak clearly and to speak well and to speak articulately. And once you had those, of course, it was rather comforting, because once you find the words, and this is something I think that goes through my work, in fact. One of the reasons I'm interested in doing Shakespeare and trying to allow it to be seen by as many people as possible is that it, for me, it gives me the words and the stories and the emotions, if you like, that are rather helpful expressions in the world at this time, because So much of our language has reduced itself. So much of our reactions to things, to pieces of art or to pieces of popular culture or whatever, are reduced to rather arbitrary superlatives. Everything's, oh, it was wonderful. I thought it was wonderful. I thought it was wonderful. Oh, it was terrible. It was terrible. And beyond that, we get stuck.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kenneth Branagh, and he directed and stars in the new movie, Dead Again, and he also directed and starred in the recent adaptation of Henry V. Have you yet directed American actors who haven't had the kind of classical training that you've had and who work perhaps on a more purely intuitive level? And if so, I'm wondering if it's different for you to direct that kind of actor than to direct a classically trained actor.
I find, you know, there are advantages and disadvantages, and there are very positive things in both experiences. A lot of our American actors, I think, have what I would describe as a sort of emotional fearlessness when it comes to acting on the screen, and an ability to communicate their performance for and to the camera in a way that is very particular and raw and good and very charged with the appropriate emotion. And I think the very best actors, whether they be American or British, have a combination of that emotional fearlessness, that ability to be very raw and real in the moment, moment by moment. So they don't make a false move, and yet at the same time they can combine a technical awareness of providing that performance and sharing it with an audience, because you have to let them in to what you are feeling and what the scene is about, even if it's just for the camera. There's a way of communicating that which means a degree of technical awareness, which does not make you a technical actor, but as I say, in the best possible world, combines this, you know, literally they can be heard, they can be understood, they communicate it very technically, assuredly, and yet it remains kind of effortless. So the best ones, and I found that perfect examples of this in American and in British actors, where their art is the art that hides the art, and it's the best of all and very thrilling to work with. But whoever you work with, you need to create an atmosphere where they can trust you.
We only have a couple of seconds left, so I need to ask you this quickly. In your autobiography, you wrote about how the thing that gave you the most stage fright, at least in front of the class, was singing.
Yeah.
Now, you open Dead Again by singing Billy Strayhorn's Lush Life, a beautiful song. I was wondering if there's any connection there.
No, I mean, there was a direction in the script that meant that I did, in fact, have to sing it. Roman was supposed to sing it, but I enjoyed that. It's much easier when you're singing in a recording studio or even in a prison cell on a film than it is when you're 19 and singing in front of a lot of people and your teachers, and you're singing the most difficult song Purcell ever wrote. Billy Strayhorn had quite a march on Purcell, as far as I'm concerned, so I enjoyed that one.
Kenneth Branagh, it was a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking with
us.
Thank you. And Kenneth Branagh directed and stars in the new movie, Dead Again. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Saxophonist David Sanborn's late night TV show Night Music showcased out of the mainstream jazz and rock musicians from a wide range of styles. Sanborn himself has played in many different contexts. He's had a successful solo career and played with Gil Evans, David Bowie, Stevie Wonder, and the Rolling Stones. Coming up, a conversation with David Sanborn. And all over America, students are dreading going back to school. So are a lot of teachers. Teacher Maureen Corrigan tells us how she's getting ready for classes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Soviet Parliament has approved Soviet leader Gorbachev's choices to lead the KGB and the Soviet Defense Ministry. Both men promised wide reforms. But Soviet lawmakers postponed consideration of other presidential appointments, and they voted to strip Gorbachev of some of his presidential powers. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from Moscow.
The Supreme Soviet was in a rebellious spirit today. It was also a bit confused over its own procedures. The parliament voted down an initial resolution to take away extra authority it gave to Gorbachev last December. But a few hours later, it reversed itself. The lawmakers explained they didn't understand what they were voting on the first time. Critics of the extra presidential authority argued that Gorbachev, or any Soviet president for that matter, won't need special powers in the future because the Soviet Union is becoming a country where the central government will have a vastly diminished role. A glimpse of the future union came in an economic and political agreement signed today between the republics of Russia and the Ukraine. The only role it left for the central government was to coordinate relations between the republics and arbitrate disputes. I'm Tom Gelton in Moscow.
Both Britain and the United States have called for totally guaranteed safeguards on nuclear material in the Soviet Union in the wake of the failed coup and continuing changes. While President Bush said that there had been no concern about something going awry last week, control of nuclear weapons has, in his words, to be sorted out. Mr. Bush also indicated that he would postpone until Monday, at least, any official recognition of the Baltic states, hoping by then that Soviet officials will grant them independence. In Lithuania, more steps toward independence have been taken, with a visit from the French foreign minister, an agreement in principle to withdraw the Soviet army, and the opening of a foreign embassy. John Boudris reports from Vilnius.
Champagne flowed in Vilnius this evening as diplomats toasted the opening of the Swedish embassy, the first of its kind in Lithuania since the beginning of World War II. Lithuanian leaders have also come to terms with Soviet Baltic High Command about the return of Lithuanian conscripts still in the Soviet army. And in principle, although no specific timetable was set, the complete withdrawal of Soviet forces from Lithuanian territory. Lithuanian leaders are pressing the U.S. and Great Britain to speed the pullout. Meanwhile, French Foreign Minister Roland Dumas presented Lithuania today with more than 2 tons of gold, worth some $30 million, held by France since the Soviet occupation of Lithuania in 1940. For National Public Radio, I'm John Boudris in Vilnius, Lithuania.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 5 points to close at 3,049.64. This is NPR News. In a strongly worded statement, the State Department said today that it is seriously concerned about the continuing fighting in Croatia and said that Yugoslav military officials and Serbian leaders have a growing responsibility for the country's movement toward civil war. A spokesman said that there is also concern that the fighting will spread. Officials in the breakaway republic say that they will consider the Federal Army an occupation force if troops are not pulled out by Saturday. After releasing one hostage last night, Cuban detainees continue their standoff with officials at the federal prison in Talladega, Alabama. Earlier today, food was sent into the unit where inmates are holding 9 remaining hostages. Debbie Elliott of member station WUAL reports.
After food was delivered into the unit for the first time in the 9-day standoff, detainees allowed prison medical staff to briefly examine the remaining hostages. Prison spokesman Greg Bogdan says negotiators are now working to secure the release of those who need medical care.
We continue to be seriously concerned about their physical and mental health status. At least two of them have medical conditions which require significant medical attention.
Bogdan will not say whether any additional food has been delivered to the unit. Inmates, meanwhile, hung two new banners today from their cell block roof. One says, "Pray for us." The other reads, "Warden, don't lie anymore." For National Public Radio, I'm Debbie Elliott in Talladega, Alabama.
A meeting of the Group of Seven aides in London indicated some of the problems facing the Soviet Union in the wake of changes there. Diplomats say it's unclear just who are the people to talk to in Moscow. However, the seven major industrialized nations have promised help in order to prevent starvation this winter in the Soviet Union. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Even if you've never heard any of David Sanborn's solo albums, you've probably heard this alto saxophonist play. He was featured on Stevie Wonder's album Talking Book and soloed on David Bowie's hit Young American and James Taylor's How Sweet It Is. You can often see Sanborn on David Letterman's show, sitting in with Paul Schaefer and the Late Night Band. For a couple of years, Sanborn hosted his own late-night TV show, Night Music, which showcased out-of-the-mainstream jazz and rock musicians. Sanborn would often sit in with them. You can hear the results of that kind of eclecticism on his new album, Another Hand, which is a departure from his previous fusion records. The album was produced by Hal Wilner, who also produced the TV show. Another Hand features Sanborn alongside an interesting range of jazz and rock musicians, including pianist and composer Terry Adams of the witty rock band NRBQ. I asked Sanborn how he decided what to do with musicians like Adams once he invited them to be on the record.
The process was with Terry, as it was with Bill Frisell and Charlie Hayden. I got together with them. In Terry's case, I got together with him up at his house in Woodstock. And we went over some of his material. I talked about was my idea for the album was kind of do a kind of more low-keyed, atmospheric kind of record, and it's certainly something different than what I had done. And we just went through all his material and found two things that I felt were appropriate for the record.
Well, I think I'll play Hobbies. Do you want to say anything about it?
Hobbies as well. If there was a national anthem for Devil's Island, this would be it.
Hobbies with my guest David Sanborn on alto saxophone. It's from his new album, which is called Another Hand.
Right. I think the subtitle of that tune is Holiday in Hell. It's definitely got that kind of slightly twisted twist, I guess you'd say.
You know, I have to tell you, when you were doing Night Music, I'd often want to see it. You'd have on such unusual musical guests.
Mm-hmm.
But where I live in Philadelphia, it was on in the middle of the night, so you had to be really vigilant to remember to, like, set up the tape machine and tape it. And was it really frustrating to do a show that was on at a different time in every city and was often on in the middle of the night?
Yeah, well, I think one of the problems that we knew about going into the show was that music shows, since the days of Don Kirshner's Rock Concert and In Concert, and in the 70s, music shows had traditionally not done very well on television. So we had that, as well as the kind of off-center nature of the show, working against us. You know, what we did was convince Michelob that there was an audience out there for, you know, a sophisticated audience out there for alternative music. And I guess, you know, that there wasn't enough time. I felt that if the show had been given, you know, another year on the air, we could have developed a larger audience, you know. I mean, as it was, we had a fairly large audience, but not enough to justify the cost of the show to the sponsor.
Is there a particular moment from the Night Music series that you think of as so odd and interesting and offbeat that you were really proud to have presented it on TV?
I think the oddest thing we had on was the residence in Conway Twitty. And I think it was interesting as well. I think one of the best moments that we had on the show was was Sonny Rollins and Leonard Cohen and Was Not Was. I think that was one of the more interesting moments that we had, and more one of the more successful moments of, you know, showing what the program was all about. You know, and it was really, to me, the essence of what we were trying to do on the show.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about your background. How old were you when you started playing the alto, and what made you choose it?
I was 11 years old, and when I was a kid, I had polio, and when I got to be about 11 years old, the doctors and therapists suggested that I play a wind instrument for therapy. And it was right about that time that I was, you know, starting to kind of really listen to music and know what it, you know, be able to associate a certain sound with a certain musician. And this was in the early days of rock and roll and rhythm and blues music. So the first music I remember hearing was like Little Richard and Fats Domino. And there was some blues, B.B. King and Albert King, because I grew up in St. Louis, and so a lot of that music was being played on the radio. And I think the music that had the most profound effect on me, and probably what really pushed me in the direction of wanting to be a saxophone player, was the music of Ray Charles. The saxophone players were kind of like the instrumental counterpart to what Ray was doing vocally, and I just thought it was such a great sound, you know. It was so hip to me.
Mm-hmm. So when you had polio as a child, how bad did it get?
Well, I was in an iron lung for a while when I was like 3 years old, and then I was paralyzed from the neck down, you know, after that for a while, and then I went through therapy, and you know, I gradually, you know, regained the use of most of my limbs. And the saxophone helped.
How did it help?
Well, it helped strengthen my lungs. It was, you know, that helped strengthen the lungs and the diaphragm. And I think that, you know, one of the things that my parents didn't expect was that it would become a real outlet for me, an avenue for me to express myself, you know, because it became my voice in a way.
My guest is alto saxophonist David Sanborn. He has a new album called Another Hand. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Alto saxophonist David Sanborn is my guest. In 1967, you started playing with the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, which I've come to think of as the blues band for the psychedelic era or something.
Yeah, well, it was kind of one of the only blues bands in the psychedelic era, although the James Cotton was working at the time.
Right.
And Michael Bloomfield was working with the Electric Flag.
Remember those days for us. What it was like for you then, touring with the band?
It was a very exciting time. I mean, you know, we were young and foolish. And we, you know, we were traveling on the road. We, you know, we weren't making a lot of money, but we were working. And there was a lot of exchange among musicians, you know, people hanging out. Jimi Hendrix was around. There was the jazz, the whole jazz scene kind of went underground, the kind of overwhelming influence of electric guitars kind of eclipsed, you know, not only the rhythm and blues music that went before, but also kind of eclipsed the acoustic sound, which included saxophones, trumpets, and what have you. For example, I was one of the only horn players that was working on the scene at that time. You know, I mean, there weren't a lot of horn players working.
After your years with the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, you ended up playing, touring with, I believe, the Rolling Stones and with David Bowie.
Well, I was actually playing with Stevie Wonder in 1971 and 1972, and we were asked to open for the Rolling Stones on the summer of 72 tour, and so I consequently got to play with them, you know, on that tour.
In their band or just opening?
Well, there were a couple of encore numbers where both bands played together.
Right, right. Let me ask you, I had heard a story once about...
About the Rolling Stones?
Yeah, I once heard
it's
a story
true,
about
whatever
the Rolling
it is.
Stones. No, about Stevie Wonder opening for the Rolling Stones and getting booed.
It probably happened, although I don't remember it. I was a little bit under the weather, or over the weather at the time.
Right. Were there things that you were... Were there things that were really fun about, you know, like a Stevie Wonder Rolling Stones tour, and on the other hand, things that were really alienating about it?
Well, it was certainly exciting. You know, I mean, there was a lot of... there was a lot of intense behavior. I don't know how else to put it. It was pretty, I guess you would say, Dionysian. I'm trying to think of all the words that I can to describe it. You know, like it was uninhibited kind of behavior that went on. And I mean, in a sense, that was kind of fun. You know, I don't think it, you know, I think what happened with me and a lot of other people is it almost killed us, you know, and I don't see how they survived it, but somehow they did. You know, I think they kind of existed in the calm center of the storm, you know, and people, you know, the storm was raging all around them, and a lot of people got thrown off, kind of, burned out. So it was exciting. I mean, I saw a lot of things that I'd never seen before.
Like what?
Well, I think just amount of just crazy behavior, you know. A lot of sexual activity, a lot of drugs. You know, not so much with them, but with the people that were around them, you know, the kind of entourage, the people that, you know, the thing that I always noticed about the Rolling Stones is that they pretty much, you know, in spite of everything, took care of business. And they may have partied heavy, but certainly not as heavy as the people around them, you know, the hangers-on, the sycophants, you know, all the people that were in the periphery, on the periphery of that.
How did you start recording solo albums?
Well, after I played with David Bowie, I was working with David Bowie, and I was also working with Gil Evans at the same time.
Now, that's an interesting juxtaposition, because Gil Evans was one of the great jazz arrangers.
Yes.
And David Bowie, a big rock star. yeah. So there's two different...
Well, I know that one of the oddest situations I can remember was I played the last show of Bowie's tour was in Madison Square Garden. And I played the show in Madison Square Garden and left there, got on a plane and flew to Italy. And the next day, I was in Perugia, Italy, playing with Gil Evans, and that was the juxtaposition of that was very odd.
You know, I know you played off and on with Gil Evans for several years.
Yes, I did.
I saw you once with him at a small club in New York, and this was in the early '80s when, I mean, your solo albums, as I believe, were selling quite well then. Mm-hmm. So, obviously, you weren't sitting in with him for the money.
No.
Why did you want to keep playing with Gil Evans, even though you were having your own successful solo albums, and you'd done quite well playing on rock records.
Well, it was such a great experience playing with Gil. I mean, he was, you know, one of the great arrangers of jazz, and certainly this century to me. I can think of so many great things about Gil's music, you know, and it was like when you were playing in the ensemble, every part was like a melody. And so you kind of wanted to play, and you felt like, you know, the part you were playing was so melodic, yet it fit with everything else that was going on. And I don't think to my ears, there was never an arranger that had, you know, that kind of ear for color and texture and the atmospherics as Gil.
You told us earlier that you first started playing the alto as therapy for mm-hmm. for your polio. Do you have any after effects from the polio now?
Well, I have. I don't have total use of my left arm, and I have some problems in my right leg.
Does your left arm interfere with playing?
Well, I don't have total flexibility in my left hand, so I mean I have problems with certain technical problems with the instrument.
Fingerings?
Yeah, certain fingerings, and I have to kind of lean a certain way to play, which is it's funny because I saw a young player who was like kind of imitating me, imitating my sound, and I saw a picture of him and he was standing like me, and with his little finger kind of thrown up, which is the way I do, but it's not because I want to do that, it's because my little finger just does that. And he kind of stood crooked, and you know, I wanted to find him and tell him, and say, look, you know, if I could stand straight while I played, I would.
Right.
You know, and I wouldn't throw my little finger up like that if I could do it. So it was just kind of odd that, you know, so I'm imitating my, you know, my compensating characteristics.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Alto saxophonist David Sanborn. He has a new album called Another Hand. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what are some of the stories you're covering tonight on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll have news from Moscow, of course. The Soviet Parliament has voted to suspend the Communist Party. The word is suspend and not abolish. 100,000 people marching today for peace in Yugoslavia in the federal capital, Belgrade, and thousands more in the capital of Croatia, Zagreb. We'll have a conversation with David Kessler, the new commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, about the experimental AIDS drug DDI, and about nutritional labeling and the safety of fish and shellfish. And we'll talk with Don Leslie, who is 80 years old now. He invented a long time ago the Leslie speaker for the Hammond organ, and it's been used ever since.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Remember how awful the end of summer was when you were a kid? Around the middle of August, department stores would start holding back-to-school sales, and Woolworths would begin stocking up on those marbleized composition books. By Labor Day, you'd want school to start already just to end the awful suspense. Commentator and teacher Maureen Corrigan says that students aren't the only ones who dread returning to school. But this year, she's gotten some fresh energy for the job from an unexpected source.
Don't get me wrong. On the whole, I love teaching, but it's hard work. In my intro poetry classes, I hear myself repeating the same points about Emily Dickinson semester after semester. It's tough to summon up enthusiasm for my stock lecture on the semicolon. Sometimes I want to cut my own classes and go to the movies, but I can't. I'm the teacher. Like lots of my colleagues, I got into this profession because I was inspired by some good teachers. But since I got my degree, the only classes I've been attending are my own, so I haven't gotten re-motivated by watching other people teach. Or at least, that was the situation until this past spring, when I stumbled into a class taught by Gina, distinguished professor of aerobics. I know, aerobics seems so foofy with its Jane Fonda outfits and disco music, but I won't exercise unless someone is making me, so it was either this or bowling. When I started, I was really alienated. Then Gina changed my attitude. In person, she sort of looks a little like gymnast Kathy Rigby, who's currently touring in Peter Pan. But if Gina were playing Peter, she wouldn't need the wires to help her fly. "Feel light, feel free," she shouts as she leaps into a jumping jack, and the rest of us flap our arms and try to take off after her. You can," she says to me as I struggle to do stomach crunches. And motivated by her encouragement, I suck my navel in and crunch. By the time I take her evening class, I know that she's usually taught two other classes that day. She's been repeating the same information about biceps, triceps, and tailbone tucks hour after hour. It's like semicolons. People need to hear this stuff again and again. Once, Gina met me a half hour before class to show me how to do a step called the grapevine. Now, to be honest, I could live happily without knowing how to grapevine. But Gina made me care about doing it right, because she cares. That's what a good teacher does for you. Aerobics instructors like Gina have no job security, and they're paid really low wages. In a way, their situation isn't so different from that of adjunct faculty. But aerobics instructors don't get any health benefits, so if Gina twists her ankle in class, that's her tough luck. There aren't many incentives for her to go beyond her bare-bones job description, but she does. I know that watching her has often recharged my pedagogical batteries. I've also been brought up short by the experience of being part of a class again. I recommend it to anybody who's feeling cynical or superior about what they do. Take a class in something totally foreign, sculpting or tractor-trailer driving. Feel what it's like to be the worst person in the class, to believe that you're so dumb you'll never catch on to what's being taught. If you're lucky, you'll have a teacher like Gina, who doesn't ridicule or leave you behind in the dust. There's nothing so humbling for a teacher as becoming a student again.
Maureen Corrigan greeted her first class of the new semester yesterday at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's reviews and interviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Joan Tuohy, with Roberta Shorrock and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Diane Middlebrook talks about her controversial new biography of poet Anne Sexton. One reason it's controversial is Middlebrook used transcripts of Sexton's therapy sessions with her psychiatrist as source material. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.